This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In recent years, we've seen some big changes in the auto industry. Annual sales have reached pre-recession levels in some regions. The government's bailout of U.S. automakers is over, and many car makers are investing heavily in new models and new technologies.
The American auto industry is back. GM is back on top. Chrysler is growing faster in America than any other car company. Ford is investing billions in American plants, American factories, plans to bring thousands of jobs back to America.
He's very excited. That was President Obama speaking to the UAW back in 2012. And now the industry is back on its feet. What kind of changes and innovations are we seeing from car makers? Well, a lot of the changes have to do with what surrounds us as we drive. Things like infotainment systems and touchscreen controls, Bluetooth connectivity. But are these features really needed? Are they safe? They're certainly not cheap. In addition to the cost of buying a new vehicle fully loaded with the latest technology, there's also the cost of maintaining these systems. A recent Consumer Reports survey found that infotainment equipment was the most troublesome feature in 2014 vehicles. Today, Where We Live, we'll be talking with two auto industry experts, asking them about these and other trends. We'll also tell you what you need to know when shopping for a new car. We've got some people here who might be able to help you out. We also want to know if you're excited by some of this new technology, if it scares you away. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in our studios in New Haven is our car buddy, Jim Motovalli. He's a journalist, a contributor to the New York Times, and a blogger at Car Talk for NPR. He's also the author of several books, including High Voltage, The Fast Track to Plug in the Auto Industry. Jim Motovalli, welcome back to Where We Live.
Great to be on.
And also with us from California today is Aaron Robinson. He's an auto industry expert, and he's executive editor of Car and Driver magazine. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
So first of all, let's just play off of the tape that we played from 2012 with President Obama, Jim. I mean, how is the U.S. auto industry doing right now? How are sales doing after this recession and after this auto industry bailout? Do we actually see people buying cars at the level that we would expect?
Oh, yeah. I think the industry in 2014 had its biggest year since about 2004. There were 16 million cars sold, give or take a few. I think this year is going to be larger than that. The industry is totally on a roll in terms of sales. The three American companies are all doing well. The industry really has very little to complain about. People are buying cars, and this is happening despite a lot of setbacks in the industry with recalls. You know, General Motors had all those safety-related recalls, and there's big problems with airbags now. A lot of automakers have had to recall millions of cars over these things, and yet the public's confidence in buying new cars has not been really affected by that. Just kind of surprising, really.
It is a bit surprising. We'll be talking about that a little later on. Aaron, what do you think is fueling this? Why this big rebound? Why are people buying cars in these numbers today?
Well, there were a lot of there were a few years there where people didn't buy hardly anything, and so there was a lot of pent up demand. And also, the products are extremely attractive. A lot of people are switching car genres. They're going from, say, mid-size sedans, which were very common, to into some new segments, such as these small sport utilities that are coming on very strong. And so, and there's all these new features that we'll be talking about later. And so, there's a lot of interest in going into the showroom right now. Plus, interest rates are very low, and people want to take advantage of that. And so it's, you know, when you look at the seasonally, what the industry calls the seasonally adjusted annual rate, you know, it was hitting almost 18 million, which is an enormous number for this market.
When you say people moving into some of these small sport utilities, Aaron, this is something that we see changing with the times over time, right? The recession hits. People aren't buying as many cars. Several years ago, we had gas pushing $5 a gallon, and people were saying, maybe we should go get a hybrid. Now, gas seems to have leveled off at a fairly cheap level. Aaron, is that pushing people into cars that are maybe not quite as fuel efficient?
That's exactly right. In fact, Ford actually closed down its Focus C-Max plant in Michigan for a few months because the demand for small cars has actually dropped while they can't make enough pickup trucks and sport utilities. So, and this has been proven through the years that people have extremely short memories about fuel prices when they actually go to buy a vehicle, and they kind of buy according to whatever the price of gas is at that moment. And so right now, pickup trucks are doing extremely well. As a matter of fact, the people who have been put out of work by the shuttered Ford plant are needed elsewhere in the empire to make more trucks and SUVs. So, you know, the demand for hybrids and fuel-efficient cars is proven to be you know, very changeable with the fuel prices.
I was just going to submit that $3 a gallon is not, to me, a low fuel price. And as Aaron says, people have very short memories about gas prices. So if you're used to $4 a gallon, maybe $3 a gallon seems cheap. But if you go back just a few years, people would have blanched at $3 a gallon gas. They would think, whoa, if it's going to go to that, I'm going to buy you know, a Honda Civic or something. And right now we're seeing people turning in electric and other green forms of the automobile in favor of these compact sport utilities and things like that. And they act like gas prices aren't cyclical, that they're not going to go up again. I think they will go up again. Mm-hmm. And people will, in some cases, regret the choices they made.
We talked for a moment about some of the recalls and things, Jim. Are the cars in most showrooms today, are they better than the cars five years ago? And I know better is kind of a subjective thing, but are they better made? Do they have better engines? Will they run longer? Are they produced in a way that might last longer? I mean, what do you see as far as the quality trend right now?
I think you have to look at it on several different levels. I think in many ways car quality has been gotten a lot better, especially among the big three automakers. They've had a real push on quality because they lagged so much behind Japan and Korea and Germany. But a lot of what's going into cars today, the new technology, the infotainment that we were mentioning earlier, I think they're putting a lot of that into cars without thoroughly testing it. And a lot of the problems that have come up have been related to that. You know, the My Ford Touch system is a good example of that. They're coming out with a new version of it, I think it's called Sync 3, that will hopefully get people over the hump. But there's a combination of, A, people not understanding how those systems work, and B, those systems being troublesome. I mean, how many people out there think that voice commands in their car work well? I mean, they don't.
Well, here's what I'll say, actually.
Strictly speaking.
I do a lot of driving, and I do a lot of calling from the road with my touch-free device. The only way I was going to actually get a new car when I got one a couple of years ago was something that worked. I found in my Volkswagen TDI Jetta, it works really, really well. And honestly, Jim, if that thing didn't work, I would have a much different experience with my car.
Well, can you say, can you call up a song and have it be accurate 100% of the time?
No, I will say I try not to do that anymore. But for the most part, when I ask it to call somebody, even when I ask it to call Kion Wolf, it understands what I'm talking about, which is kind of amazing. Aaron, how about you? I mean, this is, Jim mentioned this in the Consumer Reports study is, I think, a very important thing to look at. There's all this new technology in cars. You can buy it because it may have Bluetooth connectivity, but then it turns out to be like the most troublesome part of the car. Is all this technology really worth it right now?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, there is a big rush to try and bring what effectively is a smartphone interface, smartphone usability into the car, because the auto industry the last thing the auto industry wants is people to just forget what's on their dashboard and use their phones, because they don't make any money off of what's in your hand. They only make money off of what's on the dashboard. And the fact is that these systems have rolled out and they are troublesome. And My Ford Touch was a big reason why Ford's IQS initial quality survey ratings dropped dramatically, because the people just hated that system and had a lot of trouble with it. And Cadillac's got a similar problem with Q, its system. And the auto industry doesn't operate on the same life cycles that the electronics industry does, with you know, iPhones coming out every year or two. The auto industry works on 5 and 7 year horizons, so it takes them longer to sort this stuff out. But that said, both Apple and Google Android are kind of fighting a war for presence in the auto industry. Apple has got a deal with Chevy where they've got the system called Siri Eyes Free, which effectively brings in all the Siri function of your iPhone, and you can operate it through the dash. And then And then Google started this thing called the Open Automotive Alliance, which tries to get Android use into the car as well. So they're all kind of racing for the dashboard. The problem, of course, is that, as we well know, the electronics industry tends to roll out stuff very fast before it's proven and then kind of update it as it goes along, and it kind of lets the consumer be the beta tester. And in all likelihood, that's going to happen in the car space as well.
We're talking with Aaron Robinson, who is the executive editor of Car and Driver magazine. He joins us by phone from California today. Jim Motovalli, the blogger for Car Talk on NPR and also the author of High Voltage, The Fast Track to Plug in the Auto Industry. He joins us from our New Haven studios, and we're talking about cars and the car industry today. We want to hear some of your questions at 860-275-7266, and we'll get to those in just a moment. Jim, before we move on from this topic, though, let's talk about a few of these things. So maybe the reliability of some of these in-dash systems isn't quite there, although there is an arms race. Two things that we really need to talk about. One is the expense that they add to a car, having all these digital gizmos. And the second one is safety. I mean, at the end of the day, having a full-fledged infotainment system that allows you to listen to what your tweets are might not necessarily be the right thing for you to, you know, I don't know, get to your location safely. So talk about these two things, price and then safety.
Well, a lot of the surveys are showing that young people aren't that interested in driving. And the infotainment system actually becomes the primary attraction in buying the car. So the automakers are putting higher-priced infotainment systems into lower-priced car lines, which is kind of interesting. Like, you can buy a Chevy Spark with a really fancy stereo these days. Actually, I was just driving a Maserati Ghibli S, and I'm sure Aaron is quite familiar with this car, which actually has a Chrysler-derived infotainment system. But it had the Bowers and Wilkins upgrade, which cost $5,200. That is a lot of money for a stereo system. So you're right, they are kind of high priced. But what we're seeing automakers do, as Aaron mentioned, there's a 5 to 7 year product cycle for cars. So just putting a 5 or 7 year old stereo system in a car is not going to fly today. So I think what Tesla Motors has pioneered is the idea that you can basically download and upgrade your infotainment system with on-air downloads as you're driving. And that's why car makers, it's one of the reasons anyway, why car makers are putting 4G systems into cars, so you can have that kind of connectivity. They don't have to send you a USB stick and you do it that way. You can just have it downloaded. I remember when the first time I saw that on a Tesla, I was just amazed by it. But it's becoming the industry standard. And you're right that these systems can be very distracting to use. That's one of the reasons people have a high level of they're not happy with the systems because of how distracting they are on one level. And that's why it's important that voice commands work. I do think that on the new systems like Apple CarPlay, which uses Siri as its voice command, I think we'll see a higher level of satisfaction. That said, those systems have been rather slow to get into cars. They should have been widely available now, but I think the only way you can get Apple CarTouch at the moment is in a Ferrari. And it's funny because the companies like Google and Apple, they run on different kind of product cycles in the auto company. Companies do. So there's kind of a disconnect in the way they talk to each other and the way they communicate that it's got to get straightened out, because automakers have been promising these Android Auto and Apple CarPlay for several years, and it's really sort of agonizing how it's playing out. I do think when they arrive, though, they're going to be good.
Yeah, the next time I have to buy a Ferrari, I will remember that. I'll make sure that I can get that as an add-on feature.
You can get CarPlay.
I know, exactly. Or maybe I'll buy that Maserati just to get the $5,000 stereo. Well, you know, Aaron, you say
Bowers and Wilkins, you need it.
Oh, my goodness. Aaron says another big trend is automation. And you know, before we get to the idea of the fully automated driverless car, which we should talk about, Aaron, there's a lot of automated features in some of the cars that are out there today. I mean, what are we seeing right now?
Right. Well, you're actually kind of seeing semi-automation now. For example, in Mercedes-Benz, when you flip on the cruise control, in certain models, the car will actually steer itself in the lanes. You actually have to give a steering input every 15 seconds or so the car knows you haven't fallen asleep. But there is actually semi-automation happening already. But that's a long, long, long way from full automation where you just get in the car and tell it where you want to go. And there's a lot of infrastructure that has to be created before that can happen. And one of them is vehicle-to-vehicle communication, or V2V as the industry calls it, where the cars can actually communicate with each other. So, and with the fixed infrastructure, so cars talking to cars, cars talking to stoplights, cars communicating with central traffic command, and that's in a pilot. They've done a pilot project in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The University of Michigan's done a pilot project with 3,000 cars, and NHTSA, the safety agency, has decided that from the results of this pilot project that this is a great thing. This is going to save 1,000 lives a year and 500,000 accidents a year won't happen if this system gets fully implemented. So they're likely to mandate it, but the problem is there's a battle over frequencies. The Congress wants to open up more frequencies for free Wi-Fi, and the auto industry is saying, well, wait a minute, we wanted those frequencies for vehicle to vehicle. So there's a lot of building blocks that have to be created before we have fully autonomous cars.
I just have to say it's so interesting you say that. I mean, we recently had a program about fixing our transportation infrastructure, including trains, and why more of the train systems throughout the Northeast don't have some of these alert systems that allow trains to know what's on the tracks ahead of them. And that frequency issue is the same thing, Aaron. I can only imagine that if it's a problem for established train lines that carry thousands of people through the Northeast Corridor, that trying to sort this out for all of the roads in America and all the regions where people might drive cars, this is a little net that we might never understand. Tangle.
Yeah, this is enormous, and the bandwidth is only so wide, and everybody's kind of, you know, trying to stake out their place on the bandwidth, and the auto industry is just one voice that's kind of clamoring, and you know, our public policymakers are going to have to decide what's more important: free Wi-Fi through the town or having cars talk to each other, and. You know, so that's just one of many hurdles that the industry has to leap before the fully autonomous car will come. But in the meantime, we have, like I said, this kind of semi-autonomy that allows cars in sort of very sterile environments, which meaning a freeway where everybody's kind of going in the same direction and the access to the road is very controlled, that these cars can operate kind of semi-autonomously. And that's going to filter down from luxury cars, as all technologies do. It's going to filter down from more expensive cars into lesser expensive cars, but that's going to take a few product cycles as well, and this is going to take 20 years at least before we see any kind of really serious autonomy.
And we'll talk more about that as we come back from a break. We did send our intern Allison Ehrenreich out to ask folks around West Hartford how they felt about the idea of fully automated cars.
Have you heard about automated cars that could essentially drive on autopilot?
There definitely would have to be some research on it before I go ahead and get one of my own, but...
Yeah, see the safety specs about it first.
Quite honestly, with the distracted nature of most drivers today, I would feel more comfortable in that than I would with other people driving.
Have you heard about automatic cars?
Yes.
Would you ever ride in one?
No, thank you. I'm from the 19th century. And we didn't have automatic cars at that time, so it's beyond me.
Whether you're from the 19th century and would like your good old standard car, or whether or not you're really interested in new automated cars or some of the new features in the cars of 2015, we're talking with Aaron Robinson, executive editor of Car and Driver magazine, Jim Motivalli from the Car Talk blog, and also his book, High Voltage. We're going to be talking more about driverless cars. We'll be talking about hybrids and electrics. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, it's our annual cars show. We're talking about the cars of the present and perhaps the future with Aaron Robinson from Car and Driver magazine, Jim Motivalli from the Car Talk blog, who joins us from New Haven today. Let's go to Joan in Goshen. Hey there, Joan. What's on your mind?
Hey, I'm in my RAV4 talking through my Bluetooth, my 2007 RAV4.
2007? Wow, that's an oldster there, and it's working pretty well, huh?
Well, I refuse to upgrade. upgrade, just like with many of my computers. I don't think I'm a technophobe, but because it works so well and the vehicle is good and sturdy, it just boggles my mind that they keep adding things and then you hear of all these problems that don't work. What's up with that? I agree with you, John. I don't have my Ferrari, but the RAV4 works pretty well.
Well, hey, how important is it to you in your life, Joan, that you have a car that you can drive and use a Bluetooth that works pretty well? I mean, is that basically what you need? You're saying you don't need any of the other fancy features?
In this point in my life, yes, it is what I need. I don't know what else would be out there that would actually make me a more effective or efficient driver.
Excellent. Hey, that's a really good point, Joan, and thank you very much for the phone call. Drive safe, as always. Jim Motovalli, she brings up something really interesting. I mean, being an effective and efficient driver, I think that's one of the reasons for all this connectivity, right, is we spend an awful lot of time in our cars. We want to be able to do things safely while we're driving. Does Joan have the right idea? Find something that works for you. Make sure that you got the features that you need. Don't necessarily buy all sorts of stuff you don't.
Yeah, but the features are what get people into the showroom and probably buying the car, even if they find out later that they don't use them or that they don't work all that well. This has become a big selling point and a big competitive advantage that car makers have, is how good their infotainment system is. And there really is quite a lot you're never going to lose, never going to use, and you'll find distracting on some of the latest systems. There's actually been surveys about that people only use maybe a tenth of what the system's actually capable of. But it's probably a good thing they don't use that much of it, because it is, a lot of it, fairly distracting. Some of the systems I've used lately, I'm just amazed how complicated they make something like changing the radio station. You have to, do four or five separate actions that actually require you to look at the screen. And I don't like that. I like the old radio. You just reach over and hit the tuning knob without looking at it.
Well, one thing I have to say, and you probably knew I was going to say this, Jim, though, it's very easy. You just don't ever change the radio station. Put it on WNPR and don't ever change the radio station.
That's, you need one preset.
One preset is all you need. Bill's in New Britain. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was just wondering how they're going to prevent people from hacking the system to create havoc at intersections and things like that.
Bill, it's a great question. And Aaron, this is one of the, we start talking about connected cars, talking to one another, driving through Wi-Fi zones and everything else. Look, I got my phone hacked when I was overseas because somebody was able to pick up on the Wi-Fi signal, and all of a sudden someone's inside my Google account. Is it that far-fetched that whether or not it's a fully automated car or just a really connected car that someone would easily hack in and there's a whole bunch of trouble happening?
Right. This is a very, very serious issue to the auto industry because, first of all, the liability issues haven't been sorted out. And second of all, the auto industry up till now has kept a very firm firewall between the functioning of the car and the functioning of the infotainment system, so that one has nothing to do with the other. But as we look towards automated cars, there's that wall kind of gets breached, because you have to have some interaction between the electronics and the functioning of the car, and that is a huge concern. I mean, with Google and Apple, trying to muscle their way into the car with various systems, I mean, some concern has to be felt, because I mean, that industry, Silicon Valley, is the place that brought us Trojans and the black screen of death, the blue screen of death, and viruses and all the stuff that didn't exist before the internet. And it's got a long history of kind of rushing forward with new products and new ideas before the safety is completely worked out. And the auto industry is exactly the opposite. The auto industry has to operate on this kind of 100% safety mentality, because they have very serious liability, and it's a lot different when your computer goes to the blue screen of death and your car goes to the blue screen of death while you're rolling along at 80 miles an hour on the freeway. So yes, this is a huge concern, and it's another thing that's going to slow the implementation of full automation down.
I want to get to Matt, who's calling from Groton, to get into the next part of our conversation. He's got a question that's very near and dear to my heart. Hi, Matt. What's your question?
Hi, I was calling because I heard you drop a line saying that you own a Jetta TDI.
I do.
As well as I do. And in fact, a couple of years ago, I bought my first diesel vehicle, and I don't plan to switch back to anything else. I'm curious what the guests think of where diesel vehicles stand in comparison with all these new technologies that come out and kind of phase away just kind of the popularity of the diesel vehicles.
Matt, thanks so much for the question. And Jim, I'll put it to you because we want to turn to fuel economy and moving forward. I bought a diesel TDI a couple of years ago. It was the first new car I'd bought in some time, and I was attracted to the idea that it got very, very good gas mileage, and it does. Of course, diesel fuel is quite a bit more expensive than standard fuel right now, but it still seems to pay itself off. This is an engine, from everything I understand, that could last forever if well maintained. And what's the future of diesel in this world of hybrids and other sorts of high efficiency vehicles?
Well, there's a real sort of curious split in the industry in that in Europe, the diesel is widely accepted. There's subsidies for it. Some countries, it's like 50% or more of the market. In the U.S., it struggles to be 10% of the market. And Americans still have not got over the image of diesels as dirty and smelly and really slow, when in fact the latest diesel cars from Volkswagen and Audi and BMW and others, they're really very, very good. They're also cleaned up their act a whole lot in terms of emissions, because diesels put out particulate emission, which is known to be carcinogenic. But the latest editions of the cars are so much improved, people really should give diesel a try. You get incredible fuel economy, and as you mentioned, the longevity of the engine is a lot. And in some ways, the Germans were slow to develop hybrid cars because they kept – I've had many Germans sort of poking a finger at me and say, diesel is the way to go, not hybrids. And they finally had to bow to the inevitable and start bringing out hybrids. It was clear that Americans preferred those. But I do think that diesels are a great technology. It's one of the oldest technologies. It's almost as old as the internal combustion engine. And they work very well. I love TDIs. And also you get a huge range out of them, like sometimes 600 miles or more.
Yeah, and that's something that a lot of the other vehicles do not boast. Well, Jim, I'll ask you first, and then I'll have Aaron weigh in later. When we talk about the technologies that car manufacturers are making right now or really investing in, there's a whole range. Obviously, there's hybrid cars, and most major manufacturers have some version of a hybrid. Some have diesel technology. Some are going to purely electric cars. We're looking at propane and hydrogen and every sort of fuel under the sun. I mean, what are the trends that you see, Jim, right now, and what are the things that in a couple of years will really sort out, the ones that might end up at the top of the pack?
Well, here's a big trend that just emerged in the last couple of days. Honda had an announcement that the new Civic, which I think is the 10th generation, is going to get 40 miles per gallon. They didn't say whether that was a highway figure or combined, but that's very good. That gets you into sort of hybrid territory. And at the same time, they announced they were dropping the Honda Civic Hybrid and also the Honda Civic natural gas car, because they were selling like 700 of those a year, and there's just not enough infrastructure for natural gas cars. I actually do like propane cars a lot, but that's sort of recognizing a reality in the marketplace. Oh, they also kill the Honda Accord plug-in hybrid. They're coming out with new versions of these cars very, very quickly, but automakers are doing all kinds of things to make the traditional internal combustion engine a whole lot more efficient. They're using cylinder deactivation and direct injection and stop-start systems, and all these get you to like 40 miles per gallon on the highway without a hybrid drivetrain. So I think we may see more cheaper internal combustion engines with the magical 40 miles per gallon on the highway, probably, and that's very good. I think people will look at that. We may see right now, I think hybrid sales are kind of flat or declining. Electric cars, I think we're going to see an increase in sales of electric cars this year. But what will that mean actually is that it's a smaller percentage in terms of the number of cars they actually sell as overall, because we've been talking about possibly an 18 million car year. So they'll sell more of them, but there'll be a smaller percentage of the overall market.
Aaron, what do you see as the big trends in fuel efficiency and where you think manufacturers are going?
Well, I want to go back to diesel for a second because I'm the contrary voice on that topic. I don't think diesels are going to increase very much in the United States, and in fact, they're actually dropping in Europe. And one of the reasons is because, as has been mentioned, diesels have higher particulate emissions. And for anybody who's been watching the news, you know, Paris went through these terrible smog days earlier this year, and people identified. That the high percentage of diesel vehicles in France, 70% of the market, over 70%, as being one of the contributors. And for many, many years, the EU and the respective governments in Europe have kind of encouraged diesel purchases by having less tax on diesel fuel than on regular gasoline. That was, of course, intended to save fuel. The problem is they created this enormous public health problem with it, and now they realize that this has to go in the other direction. So they've been slowly equalizing the prices between diesel and gasoline. And at the same time, as has just been mentioned, gasoline engines are becoming more efficient. So and they're closing the gap on the fuel savings that diesels enjoy. So the market in Europe is actually going back towards small gasoline engines and away from diesel. And in the United States, the problem is our refining infrastructure isn't set up to service an enormous private demand for diesel. It's set up to service the commercial market and the agricultural market, but not this, you know, a big swell in the number of diesel cars on the road. So we just don't make enough diesel fuel in the United States to service a lot of diesel cars. So whenever prices of fuel go up, diesel actually goes up even more. So you're asking the buyer of a car now to not only pay a premium for the fuel, but they also have to pay a premium for the diesel engine itself. And it just really limits how deep diesels are going to penetrate into this country. And the people who buy them are people like the caller who they just want a 500-mile range out of their car. That's like a sunroof or a nice stereo. That's a feature that they are willing to pay for. They don't have to go to the fuel station as often, and they just like that. And so that's who's buying diesel cars. Now, as respect to other fuel economy issues, the industry is up against the wall with these CAFE standards, both here and there's emission standards in Europe as well for CO2. So they have to radically improve their game, and they're doing it not only by shrinking engines, by adding turbochargers to get more power out of smaller engines, but also by very aggressively attacking weight. And that's become really the huge issue. When you talk to car engineers now, they talk in terms of grams saved by shrinking the size of the brake pedal, grams saved by, you know, slimming down this particular component by, you know, a few millimeters. So they're so concerned with weight now that they're actually looking at each individual component in the car and just really thrifting out the weight wherever they can. And that's really kind of what keeps auto engineers up at night right now.
Is that number that we're supposed to get to by 2025, Jim, almost 55 miles per gallon, is this realistic?
I think it's realistic, and the automakers have actually embraced it. But it's funny, what's emerging is sort of a battle royal that could emerge in which Chrysler, which hasn't really done very much to get to the standards, is trying to get them postponed. And the other automakers, particularly Ford and General Motors, they're saying, no, we've invested a whole lot in trying to meet the standards, and you're just trying to get them postponed because you can't meet them. So GM, Ford, very much in favor of the standards. Chrysler, not so much. That's funny.
I want to get to one quick question here from Joseph in Stanford. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
About 25 years ago, I had a car. It was a Renault Alliance. I think it was a little rotary engine car, and I was getting 50 miles to a gallon. And I'm just wondering what happened. I have a new car now. I'm going to get in 25. Where did the mileage go? And why are we talking about getting to 50 miles, you know, 10 years from now?
Thank you for the phone call, Joseph, and you cast my memory back. I used to drive one of those Renaults. Not the classiest car in the world. It was not the swankiest ride, but it did get some pretty good gas mileage.
Not a rotary either, unless you were taking the engine out periodically and spinning it around.
No, that was Mazda that had the rotary engines.
Well, okay, but...
Yeah, and you wouldn't have been getting 50 miles per gallon if it was a rotary either. They were not known for fuel economy.
I think his point, though...
Let me point out something here. I was just going to point out that if you look back at some of the cars, you could buy a BMW Isetta where the whole front was hinged. There were these micro cars that did get 40, 50 miles per gallon, or the Volkswagen Beetle, which in its early incarnation was very fuel efficient. But in terms of emissions, those cars were terrible. I often point out to people that you may think you're all virtuous driving your old VW Bug or your microbus with a hippie peace symbol on it and everything, but in reality, that thing pollutes more than a Hummer. Sure, it's fuel efficient, but it's putting out a lot of muck from its tailpipe.
Well, Aaron, go ahead quickly if you would, just because we're up against the break.
To the caller's point, I mean, people do remember fondly cars from the 70s getting 30, 40, 50 miles per gallon. And the fact is they were extremely light. The Renault Alliance probably weighed 2,000 pounds, maybe a little bit more, 2,200 pounds. And cars have gotten a lot heavier because they've gotten a lot safer. Not only do they have more safety systems and airbags, but the structures are also a lot stiffer than they used to be. And so we've somewhat sacrificed that economy for safety. And that's why weight is such a big issue in the industry now, because they're trying to call back some of the curb weights that have been ballooning over the last 20 years because of regulation and make the cars lighter again.
We're talking today with Aaron Robinson, who's executive editor of Car and Driver magazine, Jim Motovalli, who joins us from New Haven today, who's a journalist and a contributor to the New York Times and Car Talk on NPR. He's also the author of High Voltage, the Fast Track to Plug in the Auto Industry. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we recently got to visit the Firefly Hollow Brewery in Bristol, Connecticut, and we were talking about what else? About beer. Of course, we're not talking about just any beer, though, but the expanding craft beer market in our state. Firefly Hollow is one of many Connecticut breweries. We'll talk to people in this business from across the state, and we might taste a beer or two as well. Hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today on the program, we're talking about cars, how to buy a new car, and what some of the new trends are in cars. We sent Allison Ehrenreich, our intern, out on the streets of West Hartford to see what people are looking for when buying a new car. Here's what some people are saying.
If you were to buy a car today, what would you look for?
A Cadillac.
Why?
Because I've had Cadillacs for the last 15 years, and I'm very happy the way they handle, and I'm very happy the way they hold the road, and they're very comfortable.
Any particular features you would want? Rooftop, push to start, leather seats, seat heaters, they're good for wintertime. The Chevy Cruze has Bluetooth that connects right to your phone, so I've had problems where sometimes it's distracting picking up your phone, so instead just call, when someone calls you, it just picks up automatically and can talk through your speaker system. If you were to buy a new car today, what would you look for?
I have a family, so it would have to accommodate 5 people, a dog, lots of adventure equipment like bikes and things like that. I would try to find something that was electric if possible, but there's nothing out there, so something that's responsible in regards to its use of fossil fuels, for sure.
That's what a few people are saying about the cars that they might be looking for. We're joined today by Aaron Robinson, editor of Car and Driver magazine, Jim Motovalli, who is a blogger about cars for Car Talk for NPR. And we're taking some of your calls as well at 860-275-7266. The last person on the street there, Jim, was talking about getting electric cars, and this is something you write quite a bit about. You've got a book called High Voltage, The Fast Track to Plug in the Auto Industry. Tell us where we are right now with electric cars. I mean, we've seen this thing, and we've been covering it from a political standpoint here in Connecticut around Tesla Motors, right? So Tesla makes these very high-end, beautiful electric cars that everyone seems to love. At the same time, Connecticut is putting forward an incentive, like $3,000 for people to get electric cars. It seems, though, the state is restricting the sale of cars like Tesla, not exactly figuring this out. I mean, where exactly are we in our attempt to get more people driving electrics?
Well, as you pointed out, Connecticut has just enacted a very good $3,000 rebate, and I think we should point out that it's a rebate, not a tax credit. So you can get the money at the point of purchase, and that's one of the better deals around the country. And Connecticut has been an early adopter state for electric vehicles. We're a California state when it comes to emissions, and that's why a lot of the EVs are actually sold in Connecticut among about 12 other states. We got cars like the Honda Fit EV that were not widely available. And I think Connecticut has done an excellent job of putting electric vehicle charging stations on the highways, both 95 and the Merritt Parkway. And Tesla has also used the state as a test bed for its superchargers. So there's lots of places to charge electric vehicles. In my town of Fairfield, we have 19 free public electric vehicle charging stations.
Wow.
And I'm on the committee that actually got some. Like if I go to the library, I can plug in free there. And I'm on the committee that brought a lot of the chargers into town. And I think people have bought electric cars as a result of that. People tend to think that they're going to need a lot of public charging infrastructure. In reality, about 80 to 90% of your charging is going to be done at home. And once people realize they don't need the training wheels of public charging, they are more confident about it. But it does get people into the showrooms. Electric vehicle sales have been a little bit slow this year, and it is definitely tied to that $3 a gallon gasoline we're talking about. Prices have been slowly creeping up. I'm not sure people have been noticing that. But electric vehicles are becoming part of the fabric of American life, and I think that's a good thing. It hasn't been a real rapid climb. If you look at the sales of hybrid cars, that didn't start out with a big bang either. It took a while for that to get established. But we now have a pretty robust public charging network around the country. I think people are finally understanding how electric vehicles work. And I think the next generation of electrics are going to be both cheaper and have more range. It's going to be very common for electric vehicles to cost about $30,000 before rebates and also have 200 miles of range instead of the 100 miles we have today. 100 miles is just not enough. As someone who drove a Nissan Leaf around a lot, I was always looking at the remaining charge gauge to find out how much. And it's a bit unnerving, too, because the gauge adjusts as you drive. You go uphill a lot, and you find you have less miles to go than you thought you did. And it's a problem. You don't want to run out of fuel. It's like driving a gas car that's always on empty.
It's sort of like watching your phone as you're almost out of charge and you got to make an important phone call. It's very unnerving. Well, hey, Aaron, Jim is obviously very bullish on electric cars. Where do you stand? I mean, do you think that Americans are ready to embrace this at a larger level than they have so far?
Well, we've said in the magazine that basically an electric car is a car with a 1 gallon tank of gas that takes 6 hours to fill, and that there's definitely that issue. But being the owner of an electric car myself, when you have an electric car, you realize that there's a big difference between the car you think you need and the car you actually need, and the car that you actually need doesn't really need to go much more than 15 or 20 miles a day, but the car you think you need needs to go 200, 300 miles a day on a tank of gas. But most people don't drive that far, and the electric car kind of focuses in on what you actually need. And, as Jim said, we do most of our charging, 99% of our charging at home overnight. So I love driving the car. They have a lot of tangible benefits. They're quiet. We were talking on Bluetooth phones earlier. It is the single best Bluetooth system I've ever used because there's no engine noise. And so you can, when my wife calls me from the car, I can hear her as though she's sitting in the living room. And they have instant torque, which electric motors produce. Compared to gasoline engines, so they're actually quite speedy. Our car, which is a Mitsubishi I, the least loved electric car, is very light. It's 2,600 pounds, which is light for an electric car. And we get about 70 miles range with it. And anybody who's driving more than 70 miles a day really should examine their life. I mean, they're just spending too much time in a car. So of all the people on staff, I'm actually the big electric car supporter. And here in California, Connecticut was an early adopter because they're one of the 9 states that signed on to the zero emission mandate that California initiated. And our governor, Jerry Brown, just said this year that they want to cut CO2 emissions by 40% by 2030. And so one of the ways that they have to do this, they have to do this, is to get people to switch to electric cars, because you would take that number of oil-powered cars or gasoline-powered cars off the road, and you would get them onto the electric grid, and they would be presumably charging at night when there's all this electric capacity that we don't use because we're all asleep and our electronic devices are all off. But the power company has to make the electric capacity in order to keep the grid stable. So there's all this unused electricity out there. And what Brown and the regulators in California want to do is want to shift the energy consumption from the day, from gasoline stations, to the night, when all this electricity is not being used anyway, but we're making it. And that's one way they want to achieve this big reduction in CO2.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I just want to get to some real practical stuff. And Aaron, I'll go to you first. When people ask you one or two tips, and we just have a few minutes left, one or two tips, things that they really need to know about buying a new car right now. They've had an old car. They got to go to the showroom. They maybe don't want to deal with it. What do you tell them? What's the good advice?
Well, one thing I tell them is go towards the end of the month, because car dealerships operate on monthly, what they call floor planning or monthly interest rates for the cars that they have in stock. And as things get down towards the end of the month, and especially towards the end of the quarter, car dealers get a lot more itchy about selling what's on the lot, because that's only going to cost them more money if it sits on the lot over the month. The other thing I tell them is leasing costs money. Everybody thinks leasing saves money because the monthly payment is less. But remember, at the end of the lease term, you don't have a car. You just have a lot of canceled checks. Whereas if you purchase something outright, you have a car at the end of the time you're done paying for it. And so if you want to own a car cheaply, buy a car. If you want to own a new car every 3 years, then you lease. But bear in mind that luxury comes with a cost.
Jim, how about you? What are some tips that you give people? Got about a minute and a half.
Yeah, I always tell people that you should buy a car for that you'll actually need 365 days. Don't buy one that you'll need once a year. Like, people tend to buy bigger cars than they think they need, and ones that haul more than they really need. They only once a year they move around a Cub Scout troop, and they buy a car with only one person in it most of the time. But I do find that people have preconceived notions of what they want. So when they talk to me, they want me to affirm their choice as opposed to actually listening to any advice I give them. So I've rarely influenced a car purchase. It's funny. I always tell people, oh, yeah, you'd probably be happy in a Honda Civic, but they don't really want to hear that. They've probably got some big SUV in mind, and that's what they end up buying.
Yeah, part of it is what you see yourself in. Just quickly, Jim, to pick up on something Aaron said, one of the reasons people like to lease is, you know, they get a new car every 3 years, but they also don't have to worry about all the maintenance that comes. Are new cars now so good, so well made, that we don't have to worry about that as much, the regular maintenance costs?
I think that's true. And another thing, I don't think people remember this, but cars used to rust a lot.
That's
You'd
right.
buy a car, and in 3 years, the thing would have big holes in it, and the rust would... I remember once seeing an Alfa Romeo that was a brand-new test car, and it was already rusting. But that is pretty much a thing of the past. Cars today just do not rust really at all, even in rust belt places like Connecticut.
Yeah, Jim Motovalli, who's a journalist and he's a contributor to the New York Times and Car Talk and NPR, the author of High Voltage, The Fast Track to Plug in the Auto Industry. He joined us from New Haven today. Thanks so much, Jim. It's always good to talk to you. And thanks to Aaron Robinson, who's the executive editor of Car and Driver Magazine. Thanks for getting up early for us, Aaron. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Our program today produced by Josh Nalea. Thanks so much for all the phone calls. Continue the conversation online at WNPR.org/where we live. This is Where We Live.